Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, February 7th, 2024. Let the record reflect the time is 3:17 p.m. Today we have President Representative Prox, Representative Fields, Vice Chair Ruppridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Kevin Allen with House Records, David Monroe with the LIO, and Serena Hackenmiller, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. We have one bill and three executive orders on today's committee schedule. We'll start with SB 37 from Senator Clayman's office, a bill we scheduled last Friday but didn't have time to get to. After that, we'll move into three public testimony hearings on Governor Dunleavy's executive orders. So starting with SB 37 from Senator Clayman's office, I'm going to invite the senator and his staff to approach the committee. Put your names on the record and please begin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Clayman, and I'm the state senator for Senate District H in West Anchorage, and appreciate your hearing Senate Bill 37. This legislation was brought to my attention in 2021 by Honda Motor Company and the Automotive Anti-Counterfeiting Council. In Alaska today, there is no law to prohibit the installation or reinstallation of airbags that do not meet federal safety standards. While airbags are made to protect us from serious injuries, counterfeit or non-functioning airbags are known to improperly deploy or not deploy at all, potentially resulting in serious injuries. By establishing airbag fraud as a crime, SB 37 prohibits dangerous actors from knowingly selling, installing, or manufacturing these dangerous and improper devices. The bill references both counterfeit and non-functioning airbags. A counterfeit airbag is defined as a replacement airbag displaying an unauthorized mark that is similar to a mark of a motor vehicle manufacturer or an airbag manufacturer. A non-functioning airbag is an inoperable or damaged airbag or an airbag that has previously been deployed or that was removed from a vehicle because it created an unreasonable safety risk. Similar legislation has passed in 30 states. For example, the Michigan Penal Code takes a more severe approach to this crime and punishes airbag fraud as a felony punishable by 4 years of imprisonment or a fine of $10,000. In comparison, Senate Bill 37 defines airbag fraud as a Class A misdemeanor punishable by up to 1 year of imprisonment, a fine of up to $25,000 or both, and as a Class C felony punishable by up to 5 years of imprisonment, a fine of $50,000 or both, if serious injury or death is involved. Airbag fraud has real-world implications. eBay has been a popular site for the sale of counterfeit or non-functioning airbags. This led the nonprofit corporation Automotive Anti-Counterfeiting Council, referenced A2C2, to call on eBay in October 2021 to prohibit the sale of all airbags after counterfeit airbags and related components were shown to be consistently available for sale on that site. In response, eBay changed their vehicles, parts, and accessories policy by prohibiting the sale of deployed or rebuilt airbags and airbag covers. Airbags and their accessories may still be sold by verified sellers who must verify the authenticity of the product. Passage of this legislation will support federal efforts to stop the importation of counterfeit or non-functioning airbags through the Federal Unfair Trade Practices Act. Passage of this law will allow federal authorities to seize these products at Alaska's border. Senate Bill 37 is supported by the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud, which believes in the protection of consumers and the idea that consumers should be able to trust their airbags. The state has a responsibility to protect all Alaskans from counterfeit and non-functioning airbags. This bill acknowledges victims of airbag fraud and provides consequences for those who knowingly install or provide dangerous devices. This bill also provides protection for any party involved who might not be aware of this fraud, such as owners and employees of dealerships who unknowingly install or sell those devices. My staff, Carly Dennis, will now present a sectional analysis of the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Carly Dennis, and I am staff to Senator Clayman. Section 1 of Senate Bill 37 amends AS 2835-248 by adding a new section establishing and defining airbag fraud as knowingly selling, offering for sale, installing, reinstalling, or manufacturing a counterfeit or non-functioning airbag or device that is intended to conceal a counterfeit or non-functioning airbag, or intentionally selling, leasing, or trading a vehicle that the person knows has a counterfeit or non-functioning airbag. It establishes airbag fraud as Class A misdemeanor or a Class C felony if death or serious physical injury to another person occurs as a result of the counterfeit or non-functioning airbag. Finally, it establishes that the liability of any party in a civil action is not precluded. This section provides that this legislation does not create a duty to inspect a vehicle for a counterfeit or non-functioning airbag before its sale. That concludes the sectional analysis, and I'll note for the committee, we should have one person for invited testimony, and we would ask that they be able to speak before we go to questions.
And we have a Craig Orland with American Honda Motor Company. If you could please put your name on the record and begin your invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Craig Orland. I'm with the American Honda Motor Company. The senator and his staff did a fantastic job, so I'll be brief. I really do appreciate you guys taking the time to consider this important consumer safety legislation. Unfortunately, when a lot of people think of counterfeit goods, they don't think of the automotive industry, and that's a huge problem for us because over the past several years, we've seen foreign and domestic counterfeiters flooding the market with cheap and ineffective knockoff replacement airbags. Many of these airbags are not intended to provide protection in the event of a collision. Most are filled with newspaper, styrofoam, or other debris. Some are just empty covers, and others are quite literally bombs. And if you go to YouTube, you can view a number of tests done by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration demonstrating that. These products are making their way into the vehicles of unknowing customers and have resulted in deaths and injuries all across the country. And I want to be clear that this isn't a problem with the automotive supply chain. These are replacement airbags that unscrupulous repair shops are knowingly buying over the internet and then installing in the vehicles of unknowing customers after they've been in an accident. Like many states, Alaska does have some consumer protection laws that might be helpful in prosecuting repair shops who knowingly install these products in consumer cars. But in our experience, many prosecutors aren't always as confident that they have that authority. Additionally, existing laws don't address the truly bad actors who are manufacturing and trafficking those goods. This proposed legislation would make it a crime to knowingly traffic counterfeit and non-functional airbags. That'll do a few things. First, it's going to allow folks to prosecute repair shops who knowingly engage in this behavior. Second, it's going to be allow them to target other bad actors who are knowingly manufacturing, importing, and otherwise trafficking these goods. Third, as the senator mentioned, it's going to promote state and federal cooperation to keep these products out of customers' cars in the first place, which is our main goal. And finally, it's going to give law enforcement more leverage over bad actors to get information and records from them about other potential victims of this fraud, so that they can take action before someone is ultimately hurt or killed. So while it's impossible to fully know the size or scope of an underground economy like this, we do know that it's a very real problem and that this bill is going to have a real impact on public safety. We've tied these products to death and injuries from all across the country, from Maryland to Texas to California. And additionally, through the Takata airbag recall, Honda dealers alone found hundreds of counterfeit airbags in unknown customers' cars all over the country. Our industry has worked with law enforcement to enforce these laws on a number of occasions. One man in North Carolina was arrested who made over $1.7 million in just under a year after selling over 7,000 fake airbags. And in California, we supported an LAPD raid that was made possible by similar legislation. There were hundreds of fake airbags found in that raid that were deemed so dangerous that they couldn't be transported to an evidence locker. Ultimately, the LA bomb squad was called in to detonate them. So I'm hopeful that it gives you a sense of the problem we're trying to solve here. Senate Bill 37 is model legislation that's been blessed by several stakeholders, including automakers, dealers, law enforcement professionals, insurers, the repair industry, recyclers, safety advocates, and others. Similar bills have been enacted in 34 states with overwhelming bipartisan support and no public opposition. So I appreciate your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
Before we start, I actually have a question, Senator. I think this is a great bill, but I would just ask if you'd consider Section 1, 3B. So we're also making it a crime to knowingly sell a vehicle with a non-functioning airbag, but from time to time, wrecked vehicles are sold as scrap metal or for parts. And I wonder if we maybe need an exclusion in here because it would, you know, a wrecked vehicle, the airbags deployed would quite obviously have non-functioning airbags, but you may be selling it for parts you know, and not have any intended use for the vehicle down the road, but be committing a, what is it, a Class A misdemeanor, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question you raise is valid, and the goal would not be that a vehicle that is strictly sold for parts, essentially appears to be junk and is going to stay junk, that sale for the parts should not subject somebody to liability under the statute. So that would be something we would be receptive to looking at a modification. I think one of the important parts to be aware of is that there are vehicles that are declared totaled for insurance purposes, and then there's actually a salvage sale, and then a mechanic will buy the what was declared a totaled vehicle for insurance purposes, but they're actually reparable. And those vehicles are then, they may lose their title, but then they are actually able to be retitled as a reconstructed vehicle. And so any kind of legislation modification, which I think we're very receptive to that change, needs to make a distinction between a reconstructed vehicle that now meets all the requirements, but that was once declared totaled. And I know, for example, when my family had a totaled vehicle, I just assumed the vehicle was going to the salvage yard and that was the end. And about 2 months later, I get a call from a guy who bought the vehicle at a salvage sale and wanted to know if we happened to have one of the leftover keys from the vehicle, because it saved him a lot of money if we had a key that fit the vehicle. And although my look at the vehicle said, this is done, others found it otherwise, and airbags went off, and airbags would have needed to be put back in that vehicle as part of the reconstructed vehicle. And so it would just need to be, there would need to be that distinction.
Well, certainly, Senator, and I think we could work with your office on something on that. Representative Fields.
Thank you, through the chair. I just have a couple of questions. One is, I assume this legislation is very consistent with other states, and just want to make sure the word knowingly and on line 6 of page 1 hasn't been a barrier to prosecution, where you might have, you know, a repair shop saying, well, I know I bought an airbag online. I did not knowingly buy one that was a counterfeit or didn't function. So just want to check either through the bill sponsor or the invited testifier that has not been a barrier to prosecution.
I would defer to the invited testifier, but I would just note from a criminal law perspective, there is a knowledge element of any crime, and that's the reason why it needs to be, why the legislation lists knowingly, but I would defer to the invited testifier to provide more detail.
Yeah, through the chair, I'll say every state has its criminal code is its own unique snowflake, and there are a couple of small little differences there, but this law is very similar to what's been enacted in other states. To your question about the knowing standard, that really gets to the original question that was asked before. Again, our intention is not to capture a vehicle that's been salvaged or anything like that. We want to make sure that we're going after the people who are knowingly and intentionally engaging in that. One of the reasons that this bill is limited to airbags is because it's not a do-it-yourself project. And the folks who are installing these products, you know full well, there's a lot of indicators that these products may be counterfeit. So from the way they buy them, to the way that they look, to certain markings on them that aren't going to be obvious to a layperson, but are going to be very obvious to a repair professional who's technologically savvy enough to install an airbag.
Thank you. And a different question, if I might, through the chair, I assume to the invited testifier, remind me, where are these counterfeit airbags being manufactured to the extent that you know that?
Sure. Through the chair, we're seeing them produced domestically and internationally, but I will say about 90 to 95% of these are imported from China. And again, the definition of manufacturer is very important here. What we're seeing is a lot of people are importing airbag covers that maybe don't have a Honda H or a Ford logo, Ford Oval logo on them, to bypass federal trademark laws. And then someone here in the United States is affixing those logos. So technically they would also be a manufacturer of these goods. But by and large, most of them are coming overseas from China.
Anybody else? No? Okay. Thank you, Senator. We will set this bill aside. And thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now we're going to go on to our hearings on Governor Dunleavy's executive orders. We have with us today Sean Mills from House Majority Counsel to give his brief analysis of EO 129 before we jump into public testimony. Mr. Mills, if you approach, put your name on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, esteemed committee. Sean Mills, House Majority Staff. And I'm here just to provide kind of a brief overview of what exactly this executive order proposes to do, and then sort of the underlying principles that allow for this executive order to take place in the first place. Executive Order 127.
129.
First. Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry, there's three of them. Yeah, 129 transfers the functions relating to licensure, professional standards, and administration of barbers and hairdressers from the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and it eliminates said board.
And are there any questions, Representative Fields?
Through the chair, I'm just wondering if Mr. Mills did the analysis, or maybe Chris Curtis, on how much that would add in costs. Thank you.
We do have Sarah Chambers with the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. So why don't we invite her to come up and address that question? Thank you, Mr. Mills. And if you could, maybe we'll save the back and forth and you could run through all three executive orders that we have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sure. For the record, Sarah Chambers. I am the Boards and Regulations Advisor for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And just so you're aware, I do have prepared testimony that covers all three if you'd like for me to present that at any time. To answer Representative Fields' question, we did provide statements of cost on each of the executive orders to the committee. There's no expected increase in cost for this particular executive order, and then I can address the others as they come up if you'd like.
Why don't you run through your prepared testimony on them? We'll take questions and then we'll do the public testimony. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you so much. Again, for the record, Sarah Chambers. The three executive orders being heard today propose to shift regulatory decision making from an appointed board to management within the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. As you know, the governor has an ongoing interest in improving the efficiency of state programs, and these executive orders present the potential to further that goal. Today, I'd like to address what the three executive orders would accomplish and what they would not change, as well as alleviate a few concerns we've heard from the public since their introduction. First, what the executive orders will do. First and foremost, these proposals will eliminate each quasi-judicial board overseeing their respective programs, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, and the Board of Massage Therapists, and move their decision-making authority to the department. Under the current delegation of the commissioner, that authority would then rest with the director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. This proposed change reflects how 24 professional licensing programs within the division are currently managed, including many healthcare programs. With efficiency as the governor's motive, this change would reduce timeframes for license application review, ensure swift action when challenges to public safety arise, and reduce wait times in adopting needed regulations. I want to be clear, the executive orders are not condemnations of the good work that our board members perform. They reflect concerns about how well the existing structures are serving the state and opportunities for improvement. The structure of the board as decision maker invites inherent delays. It's difficult to convene a group of busy volunteers, including managing last-minute schedule changes that could derail a publicly noticed meeting and accommodating additional built-in delays to meet public notice requirements. Board business may get pushed weeks into the future if a quorum of the board is unable to meet, unnecessarily drawing out the wait to complete board business. We understand how difficult it is for board members to cancel client appointments or request time off as working professionals. However, these conflicts impact a board's ability to function, which cascades down to impact people attempting to become licensed, existing licensees awaiting board answers to questions, as well as negative effects on public consumers. Currently, the wait time is more than doubled when reviewing and adopting regulations by a board as opposed to when the department is the driver. Looking at recent history, a simple regulations change by the division takes about 4 months versus a year when the board has requested a similar change. This impacts the ability of qualified practitioners to enter the market and suspends policy updates impacting license practice. Similarly, license applications may wait for several weeks for board members to review, only to be tabled for consideration at a meeting that could be scheduled again several weeks in the future. This does not happen with department-managed licensing programs. Additionally, a staffing restructure initiated in 2022 and affirmed in the FY25 budget adopted by the state legislature provides 17 new positions and deeper programmatic support across the division, something that didn't exist before and which previously contributed to turnover in examiner positions, especially during COVID. The same likelihood of delay is true for disciplinary matters. Investigations requiring a board member review can often take months, culminating in another protracted process of discussion and final decision-making by the board. Shifting this responsibility to the department will allow investigators to seek input on practice matters from a qualified practitioner only when scope of practice is in question. Potential violations of statutes or regulations that do not involve practice matters can be managed by a staff investigator who's familiar with the program, with a recommendation to the director for final action. Investigative timelines mandated by division leadership in recent years have continued to reduce internal case management turnaround times. Regulation without a quasi-judicial board is a common model across the United States. More than half of Alaska's professional licensing programs are currently successfully managed this way. When you look across the U.S. and its territories, there is no one dominant model of regulation for these professions. Only about half of the professions under the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers are managed by a board in other states or territories. About two-thirds of massage therapy programs are regulated by boards, and only 9 of 34 states that regulate direct entry midwifery have industry-led boards. Shifting away from a quasi-judicial board opens opportunities for the department to hear regular feedback directly from licensees, the public, and other stakeholders. The department is committed to enhancing input from stakeholders, such as establishing advisory committees, opening pathways for electronic communication on proposals for change, and holding forums and town hall meetings to seek ideas and feedback on the regulation of these professions. And state law will still require the department to seek and consider public input on regulations the same way a board is currently required to do. The department strongly believes in the need for a solid and transparent bridge between licensees and staff if the executive orders become effective, ensuring that people who've been used to a board structure continue to have an open line of communication on all matters affecting their licenses and their practice. Speaking of which, there have been many concerns raised by stakeholders since the executive orders were announced, so I'd like to assuage any apprehensions about what these orders will not do. The changes made in the executive orders do not alter licensure or certification standards or practice of any of the affected professions. The administration supports the practice of these professions and reinforces that the proposal of these orders is in no way a first step toward deregulation. Any change to state law affecting these professions would still require action by the legislature, as it does now. Any regulations change would require the department to seek and consider input from the public, as the law mandates and as the board does now. If a situation arose and it did not have the practice expertise required to make an educated decision about an application, investigation, or regulation, the department would continue to rely upon the advice and wisdom of seasoned practitioners, as it does now with all programs. We have also confirmed with the Department of Health and the Division of Insurance that licensees who are currently qualified for reimbursement by insurance and Medicaid would continue to be covered as they are now. And those letters have been provided to the committee. The time currently spent by staff to support management of a board will be reinvested in improving licensing turnaround times and increasing expertise about the profession if there are any gaps as a result of this reorganization. Division staff currently receive training and education on matters that are important to the program and that will only be enhanced going forward. A great example of this is the training our staff currently receives on identifying any potential human trafficking red flags in license applications and participation in interagency task forces relating to enforcement issues. Board members currently share in this review, but they're not the only trained eyes on these issues when they arise, which is infrequent. The training that division staff currently receive on human trafficking would only be enhanced when the executive orders go into effect. The previous points apply to all three of the boards proposed to be eliminated in the executive orders. There are briefly a few specific concerns, however, that are relevant to two of the affected boards. First, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers has multiple times over more than a decade identified needed changes in statute or regulation that would either improve policies relating to the professions they govern or clarify persistent questions that are creating confusion in the industry. With limited exception, they have failed to act on these major policy-making needs from industry. The board has frequently needed to reschedule or cancel its publicly noticed meetings due to a lack of quorum. On multiple occasions, more than a dozen members of the public have gathered to engage with the board, and the board has simply not shown up. Without a requirement of the board, the department could have moved forward in reviewing these matters and taken appropriate steps to address industry concerns, which still persist. The board has, over several years and across multiple rotations of board members, failed to perform the work delegated to it by the legislature. Not only is this persistently not responsive or responsible to the needs of industry and the public, but it's a drain of staff time and resources that could have been spent more productively, particularly on getting people to work in Alaska. Moving quasi-judicial decision-making to the department will also protect the integrity of the process. Within the last year, the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives has not been able to address certain application and investigation issues because a majority of the board members has had a legal conflict of interest with the subject, either because the board member was their employer or had internal information about the case. The board was required to remand a matter to an administrative law judge to settle the matter for them, resulting in the case taking nearly a year and costing more than $7,000, which will be paid by licensees. This situation is no fault of the individual board members. It is the result of a structure of a board of market participants that oversees a very small number of their peers. By governing a pool of only 54 licensees and permit holders, it's inherently difficult not to run into conflicts of interest in application and disciplinary matters. Conflicts requiring the board to shift its responsibilities to the Office of Administrative Hearings will only create more expenses for a program that cost licensees approximately $3,000 to enter the profession as a fully certified midwife, and a fee that must be paid again upon renewal of certification every other year. Also specific to this board is the inability of the administration to fill the physician seat, which has been vacant for more than 2 years. A lack of qualified applicants has made this extremely difficult. This and other concerns have been brought to the legislature multiple times in the last decade. One of the last four recent legislative audits recommended that the legislature look at alternative methods of regulating this profession. Again, this is not a critique of the individual board members or of the profession of certified direct entry midwives, which the administration supports. It is a flaw in the statutory structure of this particular board. The administration wishes to express our respect for the professional expertise and willingness to serve offered by all board members, and our desire to gain that benefit going forward through more efficient and appropriate means. To close, the purpose and expected outcome of the executive orders are to improve the regulatory efficiency of the affected professions without sacrificing public engagement or safety. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, and thank you for listening.
Thanks. And before that, I would ask, do any committee members have any questions for Mr. Mills, or can we release him? You do?
No.
No. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mills. I don't want to hold you here unnecessarily. Okay. Do any committee members have any questions?
I'll hold them until after public testimony.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Prox.
Thank you, Chair Sumner.
Through the public testimony. So.
I'm sorry?
We do have a lot of public testimony.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Chambers, my concern is that you might retire in 30 or 40 years, and you do a good work. I trust your work. I'm not sure about the person that's going to replace you. Have you thought about safeguards of the director or whomever, the division, somebody placed with this, not quite being as enthused about doing it right as you are?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, thank you. In fact, I did move on last year, and we found a fantastic replacement. but I do respect your concerns, and they are concerns that we've heard from the boards as well. I think that, informally, I can say that the culture of leadership and the Department of Commerce and the structures that we're putting in place and have put in place support continued movement in a way that fosters right touch regulation. In fact, that's why my new position was created, was to help continue to support boards and the staff in moving in that direction. However, no one can predict the future. Uh-huh. So, one of the points that I think is important is that any major change would have to still be done by the legislature. There is no statutory change proposed here other than changing from the board to the department, and the department doesn't retain any more power to affect the legislature. The ability to change regulations would move to the department, but that would also be a process that would require public input. And if the public found that the department was failing to regulate well, they could certainly come back to the legislature and say, well, that didn't work. We need our board back.
Mm-hmm.
We're dedicated within the scope of the team that we have. And again, those cultural changes that we've been working on for many years. We are, as I said, dedicated to creating some structures that would codify licensee input and participation, one of which being sort of a informal but transparent and publicly stated advisory committee. That's a more of a public involvement than we have with other non-boarded programs, but we think it's appropriate, especially if we're shifting from a structure where people are used to a board and now they would be going to nothing. We feel like that might be a positive bridge. So it's probably our top idea in maintaining that connection and keeping, ensuring eyes are kept on us.
Okay. Thank you, Mrs. Chambers. We're going to take some public testimony now. We do have a lot of that, but please hang on. And I think there'll be more questions. So I'm going to open public testimony on EO 129. We have... let's see, Wendy Palin, if you're on, please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. And you,
Madam, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Wendy Palin-Himmon, and I live in Palmer, Alaska. I'm a private citizen, but I am also a current member of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. I'm addressing you today in reference to Executive Order 129 and to reaffirm the critical importance of maintaining the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers within our state. As stakeholders in the beauty and cosmetology industry, it is imperative that we recognize the significance of professional standards ethical conduct and ongoing education in ensuring the safety, satisfaction, and well-being of our clients. The Board of Barbers and Hairdressers serves as a regulatory body, upholding standards of practice, licensing professionals, and safeguarding the interests of both consumers and practitioners. By implementing and enforcing regulations, this board plays a pivotal role in maintaining the integrity and credibility of our profession. There's a few compelling reasons why a board of barbers and hairdressers is indispensable. Ensuring public safety. The primary responsibility of any regulatory board is to protect the public from harm. By setting stringent guidelines for sanitation, hygiene, and safety procedures, the board minimizes the risks of infections, injuries, and adverse reactions during beauty treatment. Upholding professional standards. A board establishes benchmarks for competency and professionalism within the industry. By requiring practitioners to undergo rigorous training, obtain licensure, and to adhere to a code of ethics, it elevates the quality of services provided and fosters consumer trust. Promoting continuing education. The beauty industry is constantly evolving with new techniques, products, and technologies emerging regularly. A board facilitates ongoing education and professional development opportunities, ensuring that practitioners stay abreast of industry trends, best practices, and advancements in their field. Preventing unethical practices. Without regulatory oversight, there is a risk of unscrupulous individuals engaging in unethical practices such as unlicensed operations, misrepresentation of credentials, or exploitation of vulnerable clients. The board acts as a deterrent to such behaviors and provides a mechanism for reporting and addressing misconduct. And finally, fostering industry growth. A well-regulated industry inspires confidence among consumers and attracts investment, leading to sustainable growth and expansion opportunities. By creating a level playing field and fostering healthy competition, the board contributes to the overall prosperity of the beauty sector, which is a multi-million dollar industry for our state. With 37 years of experience and extensive credentials in corrective skincare and laser treatments, I've personally observed incredible transformations and devastating outcomes in the cosmetic industry caused by other practitioners. From debilitating scarring to lifelong disfigurement, the consequences of improper procedures can be very severe. Whether it's a simple nick of the skin during a haircut with unclean clippers, leads to infections, transmission of hepatitis B, unsanitary implements, contaminated towels fostering nail fungus, or chemical peels gone wrong causing skin discoloration and scarring, these risks are real. Even advanced laser treatments, when administered by untrained hands, can result in burns, pigment loss, and eye injuries. While our industry holds immense potential for positive change, it is crucial to prioritize proper training and certification to ensure safety and to ensure optimal results for all our clients. We need to strive for excellence in care and to prevent unnecessary harm with cosmetic procedures. In conclusion, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers transcends mere bureaucracy. It stands as a cornerstone of integrity and excellence in 48 states across the U.S. With an unwavering commitment to maintaining public trust and elevating professional standards, it serves as a linchpin for ongoing growth and success of our industry. In a world where technologies capable of injuring the public abound, it is imperative to keep the board intact and safeguard both consumers and practitioners alike. I urge you to join me in championing the establishment and maintenance of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers within our state. Together, we can uphold the highest standards of professionalism, elevate the cosmetic industry, and ensure the well-being of all stakeholders. I thank all of you for your attention to this matter and appreciate your time. Do you have any questions for me?
Thank you. Next, we have Dr. Gloria Bamberg Merritt. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Please begin.
Thank you. First, I would like to thank the chair, Chair Sumner, and the members of this committee, the House Labor and Commerce. I am Dr. Gloria Bamberg Merritt, and I live in Anchorage, Alaska. Actually, I'm a qualitative researcher. I'm also a doctor of counseling And my secondary profession is, and has been, well, over 30 years, an instructor of barbering, esthetician, nails, and even braiding. Why do I tell you this? I have been afforded the opportunity to pay for several of my educational loans due to the fact that I have worked in this field for so many years. When it comes to Executive Order 129, it leaves me with a variety of questions, just a few. Number one, why were the members of the board and practitioners not notified in reference to dismantling of the Alaska Board of Barbers and Hairdressers? Number two, who are the authors of the Executive Order 129? Why and where did the recommendation come from? Number three statement says, we do understand that the legislative body has the power to disapprove the Executive Order of 129. To veto this executive order because of the economic impact it will have on the practitioners. If my number and my memory is correct, I think it's 7,000 individuals in this profession. Actually, on January 31st, 2024, Mrs. Chambers testified. And the question was asked by one of the senators, how much discussion occurred within the industry for barber board and the practitioners? And Mrs. Chambers said, quote, no involvement. Number five, Mrs. Chambers is actually the advisor to the hairdressers and barbers board. And her job is to help the barber's board make decisions more effectively. Actually, in closing, I'm going to tell you a few more statements that's very concerning. Mrs. Chambers' report also that cutting out there will be no cutting out of this industry in reference to input. Well, I quoted earlier, there was no input from our barbers board or even the practitioners. The last statement that I have to read to you is a major, major concern in reference to the definition of the structural of the board of barbers and hairdressing. I've researched and I went back to even the recording of last week's meeting. It talks about the crafting of regulations drafted by staff who are not experts in the field. Number two, taking away institutional craft from the board itself. In the testimony, it also says direct connection with the other 40 boards. With 24 programs without board, what does that mean? How would it look and leave the practitioners and the Alaska Board of Barbers and Hairdressers as we continuously pay our fees when requested, even if they're raised, or if there's a decision to be made? A lot of the decisions are made by who? We have to ask that question. There will be a less demand, she says in her report. It reduces the need for the board members, the board not practice related to the scope, the board pull away from every investigation, basically because of this, and even less demand for the board. Well, it appears that there is a divested interest in reference to the practitioners. We're asking for your vote. No for Executive Order 129. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next, we have May Kennedy. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Going once. Oh, I can hear you. Please put
okay. your name on the record. My name is Mae Kennedy. I'm at the Anchorage office. I've been a hairdresser for 34 years. I also had the honor of serving on the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers for 4.5 years. And so I was very committed to the board, and so were the other 7. I've heard today from Ms. Chambers that this is not against the board members or against how the board operated. What my concern is about removing this executive order 129, I feel that me being in the industry, I go around and I talk to the people in the public in the industry. And there's a lot of people that are very confused about what's about to happen. Like the previous person spoke to us about 7,000. It's probably maybe 100 that notices about to take place. I feel that even when I was on the board, there's called unintended consequences. We can't not foresee what may happen if they take over it. So right now, let's say you need to get a hold of the division. You have a hard time getting people on the phone call. You may receive an email, at some point because there's 2 people. They're very busy. I get that. So adding one person to take the place of 7 board members with expertise, I'm just wondering how one person is going to do that. Yes, you will get input from the life preserver, but who decides who is to make that decision? That sometimes that particular person who they choose may have may understand hairdressing, but they may not understand tattooing. They may not understand aesthetics. This board did affect the work. Yes. Did they have problems? Yes, they did. The last couple of months, there have been issues with some aesthetic things. People wanted answers. People wanted explanations. It wasn't saying we wanted the board to go away. We just wanted understanding, because when it's messing with people's money, when it's messing with people's income, even having these meetings, like we're coming today to speak public comments, it was on a Friday. On a Friday in the hair industry is one of the busiest days. Like today, this is Wednesday. It's in the middle of the day. People want to be a part of the process. I just feel like our voice would be removed. Yes, you may get a few voices, but at least with the board, when you had a meeting, yes, you had to search it out, because we don't get letters in the mail. We don't get, the only way you know it's going to be a public comment, you got to go dig for it. And how many people are going to do that? So I feel like, yes, it will remove to where the division can go, and if something needs to be changed regulation-wise, they can just go and do that. But we need to have input. I believe that you guys have the opportunity, I apologize, the Labor and Commerce Committee, the House, have an opportunity to really research this out, listen to the people that are emailing you, that concern and figure if we was not involved in this, if we don't have a lot of input, even when it came to the board. There were times that the board did not get a lot of input. There was no public comment. So the people did not understand what was about to happen with aesthetics. They were confused. So if we can get this confusion cleared up and have the industry to be more involved in the beginning, they wouldn't be so right now figuring out, like, what's going to happen? Are they going to do this? Are they going to do that? They don't know. The public needs to be more involved. We've heard that they will, but we haven't been, probably since COVID. I don't know what happened. Right when COVID hit, a lot of things just kind of fell by the wayside. Just within the last 7 months, I've been involved. Anyway, in closing, it is so much I could say, not enough time to say it, but the main focus is help the people not interested feel like that we will have a voice. If you remove, again, you've got 7 board members that have expertise, and you're going to put one person in that. I just don't see how one person is going to take with 7 people with expertise. Yes, you're going to be able to change regulations. Yes, there's some middle things that will be changed, but there are things that we want to feel like that we can be more involved. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. That's everybody I see online for Executive Order 129. We'll come back to the room. Is there anybody in the room wishing to testify on Executive Order 129, Board of Barbers and Hairdressers? No? Okay, we will close public testimony on EO 129, and we will open public testimony on EO 127. I unfortunately am going to have to require people to keep their testimony to 2 minutes, or we will not be able to hear from everybody today. So going first, we have Volker Ruby. Sorry if I mispronounced that, but please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm a lifelong Alaskan licensed massage therapist and served 6 years as president of the Alaska chapter of the American Massage Therapy Association. Oh, by the way, my name is Volker Ruby. Okay. Getting rid of the Board of Massage Therapists with certainty will raise costs to all of the more than 1,200 massage therapists in Alaska. This was overwhelmingly stated by legislative auditors. State staff does not have the expertise to fairly decide massage industry details relating to scope of practice, professional standards, or regulation changes. Unless the state staff end up going to massage school and then working for years to gain experience in the field, there is no amount of additional training that will give them this knowledge. There is already a state board containing massage therapists who are volunteers to decide these details in a public forum with input for our massage community. The state would have to hire additional staff who would still not have the know-how of trained massage therapists. This would require the hiring of paid experts or creating advisory committees. These increased costs would be borne by the massage therapists. It would decrease efficiency. There is a clear danger to the public if EO 127 is not disapproved. Massage therapists on the state board are able to identify anticipate details in applications, complaints, or investigations that help keep the illegal elements out of our profession, such as human trafficking. State staff would not have the skills to identify the intricate details of our profession. New and revised regulations are routinely required for public safety. The state board are the ones who identify these. Without the state board, this process would go away. Our profession and our professional standards would be in the hands of staff who could never fully understand the intricate workings of our profession unless they are massage therapists themselves. All of these issues I've mentioned here and many others will greatly decrease efficiency and increase costs to all massage therapists in Alaska. I urge the committee to disallow Executive Order 127. Thank you for your time. I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Next, we have Shanti Trevelyan. Sorry if I mispronounced that. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, yes. My name is Shanti Trevelyan. I'm a licensed therapist here in Alaska. I have been practicing massage for the last 25 years, so I have a good bit of experience in our profession. And while I did appreciate Sarah Chambers' assistance in getting licensed, I also do not want to support any stepping back in the regulation of our profession. We're a highly sexualized profession, and we know how sexualized we are and what to look out for to protect not only ourselves, but the public from therapists that may not be practicing ethically and businesses that want to come in and pretend to be a part of our profession but are not. So there are things that only we will know. I recently had to take the word roses off of my webpage because it is apparently a keyword that is drawing people. It's something that's built into this industry that we should not have to yield, but we do deal with this on a regular basis. So we need to have a very strong relationship between the board and the profession and the regulations. And so I would like to see more support of the profession by a partnership. So that means I would say no to this current proposal, but yes to something in the future that's more supportive of both the regulation of the board and the regulation of our profession and support of our profession.
Okay, thank you. Next we have Jill Motz. Has you down for questions, but I wasn't sure if you want to testify.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. I'm the immediate past chair for the State Board of Massage Therapy. I'm here today to answer questions if anybody on the committee has questions, but I was asked to come back for invited testimony at another date.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, you can ask. Representative Fields does have a question.
Well, I was just going to ask you, Mr. Chairman, so we are going to have invited testimony on this later, or should I ask questions now?
We can do invited testimony.
Okay, sounds good. I'll wait to get through public testimony.
Okay, thank you. Okay, going back to the room, is there anybody that wishes to testify on EO 127? Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Representative Sumner and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing testimony today on EO Executive Order 127. My name is Tracy Gilmore. I live in Juneau. I own a massage business and I'm past vice chair of the Board of Massage. I would like to focus on the increased layers of bureaucracy this EO will encourage. In a more conservative world, smaller government is sought, resulting in reduced costs to the public. No less than two positions have been or will be created in order to eliminate highly trained, knowledgeable volunteer board members who possess decades of information available to licensees for the price of holding meetings. Licensees deserve a fiscally responsible government that doesn't create more debt for them to carry. Should EO 127 pass, Boards and Regulations Advisor Chambers has confirmed that a position will be created to accompany the licensing examiner who supports our program in exchange for a volunteer board. Advisor Chambers herself is in a brand new position of upper-level management that began in January 2024, possibly December 2023. Her previously held position as Director of CBPL also oversaw boards and regulations. This newly created position's costs are spread across all licensing programs and will increase licensing fees for your constituents who already feel these fees are burdensome. I don't see efficiency in adding to the burden of costs, time, and additional employees in exchange for board members who volunteer their time. Board experience has been that staff are rarely on the job long enough to understand the nuances or hold the program close to their heart and create a passion for our profession. I don't know this is by design, but it doesn't feel good every time the board has to train a new examiner about the intricacies of our industry. It feels like well-constructed chaos. High turnover means decreased efficiency and a threat to public safety. Trading the passion and institutional knowledge possessed by therapists who have practiced for decades for lack of knowledge and short-term training of rotating employees is certain to increase the probability of fraudulent applicants being approved and fostering human trafficking without intending to do so. Lack of knowledge for our program leads to lack of concern for moving applications and responding to complaints in a timely manner. Our industry specifically is fraught with human trafficking and sex workers that the board has diligently worked to keep out of our state. The message from day one of this board to human traffickers is turn around, get out. Our state will not host prostitution and human trafficking. You will be removing passionate members of a board for entry-level state employees who seek to move up to more highly paid positions within a short period of time. They cannot be expected to be invested in our programs. These are not long-term career opportunities like the one afforded for Advisor Chambers. In summary, we want to keep our seat at the table. We want legislators to be able to have oversight of programs. We do not want our licensing fees to rise without a voice in the conversation. We want to stem the tide of human trafficking. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the room wishing to testify on EO 127?
I have a question.
Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I have a question for Mrs. Gilmore.
Oh.
I was not aware that DCCED was already adding staff. I guess in preparation for these EOs, and could you give us an understanding of what you anticipate as associated costs on licensees with adding staff? Thank you.
Sure. I cannot, through the chair, Representative Fields, I cannot speak to the dollar amounts, but what happens when you add staff, and since I left the board 3 years ago, I now, in order to contact the occupational licensing examiner, I have to go through a receptionist that fields my calls. So when I called to speak to our licensing examiner, I was on when you call, you can be on hold up to 20 minutes, and then you will get be able to leave a message. I was able to get directed to our occupational licensing examiner, who then says we have a staff shortage. It could be up to 5 days for me to get a reply. Then I got was called back by the program coordinator, who costs more than our occupational license examiner. And really, we learned to be really financially conscious, being a new board. And so that, for me, was personally affecting, because program coordinators cost more to talk to than occupational license examiners. But it was the fact that we have a new receptionist and you have another layer to go through that I was like, I don't know when I'm going to get contacted then. So it did. That one was, I can't speak to it, but that, if that person is responding to everybody, all boards, that money is spread across licensing programs, as is anybody that oversees those. A personal new employee for a massage board to replace massage, that is money that will increase our licensing fees. It has to. It has to.
Thank you. So I guess I'll ask again, is there anybody else that wants to testify on EO 127? Seeing no one else, I will close public testimony on EO 127. And we will open public testimony on EO 130. Is there anybody in the room wishing to testify on EO 130? Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony. And we will, I apologize, but we will have to limit it 2 minutes because there are almost 30 people or maybe more. Yeah. So.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mariana Gawa. I am a licensed certified direct injury midwife practicing in Wasilla and the surrounding areas. I flew to Juneau to be here for this meeting. So thank you for allowing me to speak. I would urge you to strongly oppose Executive Order 130. The downstream consequences of removing the Alaska Board of Midwives is to be determined. We can only speculate what may happen or what may not happen. The administration has not planned ahead and made a solid policy for what happens if this executive order goes through. They are only speculating what may look like an advisory committee. The advisory board is only an idea. It is not something set in policy or worked through with the necessary policies and standards for oversight. We just don't know how removing an autonomous healthcare professions board of their peers and transferring those responsibilities and duties entirely onto an understaffed division within the Department of Commerce will affect the health and safety of Alaskan families. We're talking about mothers and babies. Please help us, the professionals practicing now, as well as future midwives, to thrive and flourish in their businesses. Please vote no on EO 130. On that note, I would like to talk about the future of midwifery care. I have been honored to be a preceptor for 5 different apprentices over the years. 4 of them completed their licensing processes and became licensed practicing midwives. My last apprentice is now finalizing her paperwork and getting her ducks in a row to sit for the national credentialing exam through the North American Registry of Midwives and submit her application to the state for review. I hear from her when she speaks to me with fear about the uncertainty of the future of midwifery in Alaska. Will we be looking back at the good old days of midwifery and think on how we used to be able to provide care, bill insurance, act as autonomous providers practicing at our full scope of training and expertise? Or will we continue to thrive as a profession? The administration has been misled into thinking this is a good idea. In close, I would ask you to consider whether this move by the executive branch to remove legislative oversight from an important healthcare industry. Correct me if I'm wrong, but if the board is disbanded, the legislative auditing process ceases to exist. I urge you, the House Labor and Commerce Committee, to move this executive order through your committee, report it back to the legislative body that your recommendation is to vote no on EO 130. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Is there anybody else in the room wishing to testify? Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm Dr. Jennifer Joswiak. I'm a chiropractic physician here in Juneau, Alaska, the last 18 years. I personally have used midwifery services. I employ three massage therapists in my office. I work with families, mothers, babies on a daily basis. So I'm interacting with massage therapists, midwifery patients, midwives. There's an active referral network back and forth. And I'm here to urge you to vote no on Executive Order 130. The level of education, you cannot train to state employees. There's things that just take years of continuing education to do. And I fear that there will be families and babies that suffer from lack of knowledge, of ignorance. We are already in Alaska where it's medically underserved. And it is important to be able to have a trusting relationship and keep our standards high. I have a very good reputation, and I trust the people I work with. And I believe that my patients come to me because I have a high standards. And I just think it's very important that we understand that education takes time. And it can't be brought in on a state employee staff that doesn't have that background. So thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else? Please approach, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak about this issue, which is very important to me. My name is Hannah St. George, and while myself, I'm not a licensed midwife, I am the mother of 10 children, and I have served for 5 years on the board of midwives as their public member. I have seen firsthand how much work and effort these women put into their role as they ensure women throughout Alaska have access to quality medical care during some of the most frightening and vulnerable times of their lives. I don't feel the need to remind you of how important midwives are to women in Alaska. Alaska has some very unique challenges trying to provide quality care to mothers not only in our urban cities but throughout our rural towns and villages. What I do feel an urgent need to convey to you and to anyone that will listen is how instrumental the Board of Midwives is to maintaining these birthing options for future generations of Alaska women. I myself am done having children, finally, but my daughters are not, my future granddaughters are not, and we need to protect their choices and options just as vehemently as we would our own. I understand that if the board was dissolved, nothing would change the next day. Nothing may change for the next year or the next 5 years, but currently decisions about Alaskan midwives are being made by experienced Alaskan midwives. This is what would fundamentally change. This current administration says that they don't intend to make any meaningful changes to the way midwifery functions in Alaska, but that would suddenly become their choice to make instead of a decision for wise, experienced midwives to make. What about the next administration? What about the next? And please, let's not kid ourselves. There's a lot of money involved in healthcare, and specifically in this area of pregnancy and birthing. Are we supposed to believe that larger hospitals and clinics and special interests that work on their behalf have no vested interest here, and that they are happy women have access to other choices and would never lobby to change future policy for their advantage? This is the core of the threat we face here with these prolonged changes. Decisions affecting your family's future, access to birthing options, will be moved one more step further away from them. It will be moved here to these halls along with so many others. Please do not allow this to pass. Keep these decisions where they belong, inside a governor-appointed board of experienced professional midwives that understand how those decisions affect women and babies that they so diligently serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we will go to the Matsu LIO, Bethany Kirilov. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, yes, my name is Bethany Kirilov today, and I come to you today asking on behalf of all the people that I serve for you to vote no on Executive Order 130. I'm a mother of four, all born with midwives. It costs the state far less to pay a home birth midwife for a low-risk out-of-hospital delivery than it does the average hospital. I disagree with this order partly for the fact that it will not save money for our volunteer board to be replaced by paid employees of the state. Common sense says it will cost more to bring in paid employees and will add bureaucratic layers rather than streamlining. Bear in mind these paid employees are not experts in midwifery and cannot understand the amount of nuance and serious implications that are commonplace in making daily decisions on things like education, best practices, and disciplinary matters. By removing the Board of Direct Entry Midwives, you're taking the education that I and my sister midwives got over the course of several years, and you're spitting on it, saying we can do better than the experts of this field. You're taking our collective years of experience and denying it. I'm a permitted direct entry midwife apprentice, and I have been told that insurance coverage will not change with the shift in power. Excuse me, but I don't believe you, because insurance is interested in not paying. They can't see the forest for the trees. So far, the state has showed me that they believe us midwives cannot manage ourselves, so we must hand our autonomy over to non-healthcare employees. I have come to the point in my career where I have finished with my requirements to license, and now I'm faced with the probability that I will be practicing as a newly licensed midwife with my hands tied firmly behind my back. Removal of our board will absolutely interrupt billing processes. How long does it take to fix the Medicaid laws? So far, it's been a number of years since they've been updated. To you, they're a small 6% on a piece of paperwork, but to me, they're my life. Their faces, births, babies, and stories are forever etched in my memory and will be a part of me long after I'm gone. Our wives, daughters, and grandchildren deserve to have a choice as people. Alaskans should not be backed into a corner because of insurance access. Mark my words when I say I will continue to speak up for access, safety, and healthy options for mothers and their families. I will not stop fighting. Midwives are not going to quietly go away and give our power up to those that do not have our beloved patients' best interests at heart. Vote no on Executive Order 130. Who is this for? Alaskans? Midwives? Neither. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Laura Lemons, the Wasilla LIO. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Wait, is unmute? Do I just unmute?
We can hear you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Laura Lemons. I'm a direct entry midwife licensed in Idaho and in Alaska. I practice in Wasilla and the surrounding vicinity. While I've had my own issues with obtaining my license here in Alaska, I have serious concerns about and do not support Executive Order 130. I don't believe it is in the best interest of mothers or babies in Alaska. I echo what everybody else has brought up today, even the massage therapist and the board of barbers, we all have the same concerns. In regards to how Executive Order 130 will be implemented, I have concerns about how the state will manage the fallout of these changes and how it will affect the profession of midwifery. At this point, there's no specific plan for a midwife advisory board, and that's concerning to me. I would like to see midwives being governed by other midwives. It is important that midwives help to draft up updated statutes and legislations and regulations. I don't believe that a committee in the government that has no stake in furthering midwifery will be as diligent in keeping things updated as a board of my peers. I listened to the midwives board meeting today, and there was no specific plan for an advisory board, just that midwives would be represented and listened to. It was very ambiguous. With regards to our concerns about billing, there was some letters that were shown, and I believe you all have a copy of those letters. But that doesn't guarantee that we're not going to go backwards. There was a time in Alaska's history when we could not bill insurance or Medicaid. I see that happening in the future, and that's really scary for me. One thing that was stated was that our board is small, and there aren't many of us, so it would be better to move our board to the Department of Commerce. Just because our board only represents a small amount of people compared to other healthcare boards, it doesn't mean that our concerns should be waylaid or pushed under the rug. All other autonomous healthcare providers are represented by a board of their peers. Get that. We are autonomous healthcare providers. We should be governed by a board of our peers. I'm also an Indigenous midwife. I think I'm one of two in our state. I am also an Indigenous doula, and I work with Alaskan families, with the Alaska Native Birth Workers community. I'm concerned that if this gets passed, a vital choice for our people coming in from the bush will be taken away. I have seen in just a year that I've been practicing, many women and their families come from places such as Nome, Barrow, and even Valdez, because they want a choice They don't want to give birth in the hospital. This is a choice I want to protect.
Lemons, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Dr. Stacy Lowe. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
My name is Stacy Lowe. I'm a chiropractic physician. I've been in private practice in Wasilla for 19 years. Because my practice focuses on pediatrics and pregnancy care, I've worked closely with direct entry midwives all of these years. About 95% of my pregnant clients are using direct entry midwives, and I'm concerned for our mutual patients and that their access for insurance billing and care will be denied at some point. I'm here today to express my concern that as an autonomous healthcare provider myself, the direct entry midwives also act as primary care, they have the authority to diagnose, bill insurances, and they may have their ability to self-govern taken away from them. Ms. Chambers alluded to other healthcare providers in the state of Alaska that do not have their own self-governing boards, and I challenge to know if they are as autonomous and their own providers and primary care as these direct entry midwives are. I don't know any other healthcare profession who does not operate with the board of their peers, and I'm very concerned that if this executive order goes through, which professional healthcare board is next? Is this setting precedence to remove the self-governing care that we do have over ourselves and opening it up for government oversight? It is obvious to me that a profession that has such monumental responsibilities, caring for the lives of women and babies, would be treated in higher regard and have an infrastructure to govern themselves, both in conduct and scope. I can't imagine the difficult job that each and every one of you have right now to learn about and possibly vote on 12 different executive orders. What I can say is, if the day comes to place your vote on Executive Order 130 and you don't know what the scope of a direct entry midwife is and all of the lives they impact, I mean this very respectfully, but the vote should be no. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Denny Oren. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Denny Oren. I am a mother of two at the Soldotna, Alaska, and as someone who has birthed both in a hospital via an OBGYN and a midwife and birthing center, I am strongly opposed to this Executive Order 130. My care was by far better in the hands of a midwife and a birthing center than it ever was with an OBGYN or in a hospital. In a hospital setting and an OBGYN setting, I was not given informed information on my pregnancy or my labor and delivery or my postpartum. With a midwife, I received informed information to make my own choices throughout my pregnancy, throughout my delivery and labor, and with my postpartum. I urge everyone to take a look at this and strongly oppose the Executive Order 130.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we move to Melanie Overman. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Okay. Can you guys hear me?
We sure can.
Okay, great. My name is Melanie Overman. I live in Kenai. I don't have a whole lot of time, but I just want to say that my life has been very greatly changed by midwifery care. And I think that outsourcing the legislation of midwives is not a great option for mothers in Alaska. So I do oppose that. That's all I have to say for now. Thank you for holding this meeting for us.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Emily Heal. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Hello, my name is Emily Hale, and I hear the concerns of the testimony before me, and I oppose Executive Order 130. I am not a midwife, but it was with the support of my midwifery team that I have my child today. I feel EO 130 will limit the already limited options of pregnant women in Alaska. It is imperative that midwifery remains a viable option for all Alaskans in perpetuity. And to recap, I strongly oppose EO-130. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we will move to Jennifer Redding. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Moving to a board of executors, that moving away from a board of midwives is insanity as far as I'm concerned. I am one of the few that have survived a uterine rupture in this state because I had a midwife with me. When Western medicine forced me through a cascade of unnecessary intervention for my first child to have a C-section 2 weeks early because my baby was big and I was forced into that, when I refused to go back to the hospital for my second and said, no, I don't care, not going. And I was lucky enough to have my midwife be present when my labor stalled, or that was my thought, when in reality my uterus had ruptured, my baby and I were about to die. And you want to take away the ability of midwives to regulate themselves? No, just no. Because women like me that are here that don't want to go back to the hospital and will not go back to the hospital are going to be the ones that suffer. And our death rates that are already insane in the U.S. are just going to get worse when you take away our right to choose our health care. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Miranda Bauer. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Miranda Bauer of Palmer. I am not just a concerned citizen, but also a mother of four children, all born in Alaska, with the help of direct entry midwives. I also stand as a business owner of postpartum training companies that has trained providers, including midwives, in over 40 countries for the last 15 years. I've done this work. The issue at hand, EO-130, threatens to dissolve the Board of Direct Entry Midwives in Alaska under the guise of saving money and streamlining administrative processes. However, let us be clear, this is entirely false. This board is a self-governing board of volunteers with an excess of $70,000. And dissolving this board would require the state of Alaska to pay their employees to do this work instead. Not to mention, in 2022, several errors were made by the chairman herself and the state of Alaska, costing thousands of dollars. The governor, the department, and auditors all have affirmed that these past errors were not the fault of the board, but rather the department's leadership, its public record. Yet despite this acknowledgement, despite clearly self-efficient, self-governing board, the proposed solution is to dissolve the board and throw its responsibilities onto an already overstretched state employee's hands who lack expertise in the midwifery care. And the most concerning is that there is no plan. There's a huge grave oversight regarding the impact of this decision, one of them being that dissolving this board puts a stop to their ability to bill Medicaid, which is 45 to 85% of these practitioners' incomes and businesses. To directly address your quote-unquote misinformation, Sarah Chambers, on this very topic, it states on Medicaid Provider Billing Manual, Section 1, page 5, I quote, individuals who have a current certificate for the Alaska Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives to practice as direct entry midwives may enroll with Alaska Medical Assistance, meaning they cannot qualify for Medicaid billing without the board. So if you vote no, every single one of these direct entry midwives will lose their entire businesses and livelihoods. And let's not overlook the differential impact on direct entry midwives versus certified nurse midwives or CNNs. CNNs operate under a different board, and I understand one particular CNN is telling legislative members that voting in favor of this will be absolutely fine. Well, that's because her business won't lose the ability to bill Medicaid, and Ms. Barb will get to grow her birth center and profit from the loss our community faces. This fact is that birth centers and our options for home births are going to dwindle. Maternal and postpartum health care outcomes are going to suffer. And study after study underscores the cost effectiveness and superior health outcomes of direct entry midwifery care. And ignoring these facts in the name of efficiency, which we've already established isn't a problem, is not just short-sighted, it's really reckless. So I urge you, as stewards of our state's well-being, to carefully consider the implications of your vote. EO 130 must be rejected. Wow. Vote no. The power to make the right choices in your hands, and we need to choose wisely for Alaska. Thank you.
Through the chair, I just wanted to clarify for the testifier that I think the certified nurse midwife who submitted public testimony was actually opposing the EO and supporting continuation of the Board of Direct Entry Midwives. So thank you to that testifier for her testimony.
Thank you, Representative Fields. Next, we have Rachel Pugh. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Rachel Pugh. I am a certified professional midwife and certified direct entry midwife, and I currently sit on the State Board of Midwifery you'll be discussing today. I have some real concerns about this executive order in regards to midwifery. Everyone keeps trying to pacify us with statements like, nothing will change, you'll be able to keep practicing like you already are, and you'll still be able to bill insurance, including DKC, and that's not what the EO says. But no one really knows how this could pan out. So my biggest concern is not what the EO states right now. My biggest concern is what it doesn't state and what it can potentially mean for the future of midwifery in Alaska. Simply dissolving the board into a state department does have an immediate impact on our statutes and regulations because it starts the process of changes that we will not have a say in as autonomous healthcare providers. We've been told if there are questions and issues with our scope of practice, there will be an advisory committee or some professional consultants, but no one can tell us who will be on these advisory committees or who these professional advisors will be. All we know is the decisions will not be made by midwives. No one can even tell us what the criteria will be to be qualified to be on such a committee. How is that in the best interest of public health and safety? As autonomous healthcare providers with a very unique scope of practice, this is extremely concerning. So when you vote, please vote no on EO130. And when HB 175 comes in front of you, please vote yes.
Thank you. Next, we have Christian Lowe. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Christian Lowe. Thank you for allowing me to give public testimony today regarding Executive Order 130. My wife and I are lifelong Alaskans and parents of three. My wife, Leia Lowe, gave birth to our first child in 2019 at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. She gave birth to our second child in 2021 at home under the care of a midwife, and our third child in 2023 also at home under the care of a midwife. To keep things short, the experience of birth at home under the care from our midwives was far superior to the experience in the medical system. Executive Order 130 takes the power of regulation of midwives in Alaska away from professionals in the space and puts it in the hands of bureaucrats who are instructed to gather information about midwifery from professionals in the space and then make regulatory decisions based on what they gather. This introduces the possibility of regulation being adopted that would hinder the ability of a licensed midwife to care for the client as they deem necessary as a professional in the state. As a lifelong Alaskan, I implore you to vote no on Executive Order 130. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Kaylee Presley. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi there. My name is Kaylee Presley, and I am testifying why I vote no on Executive Order 130. All women deserve the right to choose where they give birth. Alaska has a wonderful system so far with great birthing options for women. Midwiferies and working with midwives in personal homes are safe places to give birth. Midwives have been operating on their own board for some time now, and things do not need to change. With all due respect, the best people to make decisions about midwives are midwives. No random group in the government office is able to have the same insight as a group of midwives focused on their specific field. This is overstepping of the government. We do not need this part of our medical field overseen by the government in this way.
I have given birth out of midwifery and had the best birthing experience. My midwives were kind and gentle and made safety their top priority. They offered a wonderful way to give birth, and as a woman who has experienced a birth out of midwifery, I find it more comfortable to be in an environment like that. I felt safe, seen, heard, and taken care of. I never doubted my midwife for a moment. She is confident and secure. She is well-trained, and her specialty is midwifery. The only people in charge of a midwifery board need to be a group of midwives, as it already is now. I find this executive order to be thoughtless and hurtful to the women in this state that need care to be overseen by specialized and qualified people. I'm concerned for my future care as I go on to have more children, and I know many other women who have the same worries I do. We want the choice to use a midwife who is overseen by other midwives. I would not feel safe having a random group in charge of overseeing my midwife. They hold themselves to great standards. If you look at the data, they have an extremely good rate of successful deliveries, in fact, higher than most hospitals around here. Please hear us all as we give our testimonies and get rid of this Executive Order 130. We, the citizens of Alaska, am I out of time?
Next, we have Chelsea Haponsky. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, this is Chelsea Haponsky. I am a chiropractor down in Ketchikan, Alaska, and a mother of five. I had three of my kiddos in a hospital, and my last two I used a direct entry midwife. And I can tell you that it was a night and day difference in my labor and delivery. I definitely have some concerns as another healthcare professional. I'm not really sure, and I don't know that trying to clean things up and make it more cost effective for the state is a legitimate reason to do this, and nor do I think that that's actually what's going to happen. Because, again, you're taking a voluntary board and placing those duties onto paid positions, which, again, we're already short-staffed in the state anyway. But as somebody in another healthcare board, I can't imagine seeing any other healthcare board being reduced or abolished and kind of taken in by the Department of Commerce. There's a lot of things that a board does as far as statutory, regulatory things, and continuing education, making sure that the licensees have the highest level of education. And again, I, as another professional, want to make sure that all healthcare professionals are abiding by those guidelines. And if we move the midwifery board under the Department of Commerce, I don't see how that can be maintained without the input of the midwifery community. Midwives in the state also save the state thousands of dollars every year by helping those mothers who have low-risk pregnancies deliver in birthing centers and at home. So I think that it is very important that these midwives license. I also have some concerns on the letter that was sent out by Lori Wing Heiler, the director. As far as the insurers and payers, in her letter, she states that the division believes that if midwives and or massage therapists were billing insurance before this executive order, then they will be able to bill going forward.
But you can finish your sentence. I just wanted to know that it went out.
Anyway, my concern is that, again, there's nothing that states with certainty that payers are going to be required to still cover those services, nor any future midwife who gets licensed in the state would have access to those services. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to move to Max Roney. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Hey, this is Max Romy, and I am calling because the scariest day of my life was a little over a year ago, birth of my first child. My wife saw a certified nurse midwife and certified direct entry midwife. They assisted with the birth and made me appreciate all the skill and work that goes into it. And during this testimony, you keep on talking about efficiency. which is a word that I shudder to hear in the same sentence as midwifery and birth. I mean, like, our certified midwives are focused on doing the best job and the safest job they could, which they did. They got my wife to a 27-hour labor, and they delivered a priceless healthy baby boy. They did a great job, so I support midwifery in Alaska and allowing them to continue to do the great and important work that they've been doing and keeping the power in their safe and capable hands and not in the hands of an agency that is obsessed with the word efficiency. That's why I oppose Executive Order 130. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We move to Jessica Johnston. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Hello, my name is Jessica Johnston. I'm a certified professional midwife and a perinatal workforce development consultant. I want to bring some attention to some direct numbers associated with the cost of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. The Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives costs the state of Alaska right now $0. The Board of Midwives is paid for specifically by revenue generated from licensing fees. So any movement away from this structure will increase costs. I'd like to highlight that actually also that certified direct entry midwives save Alaska and Alaskan Medicaid on at the bare minimum $5 million a year every year by being able to provide Medicaid insured clients with home birth and birth center services. By just attending in 2022 alone, by just attending 567 births in the state of Alaska, we saved Medicaid $5.161 million. The average facility fee that the hospital will bill Medicaid is $26,659. The average birth center fee is $2,603. And home birth fee is nothing. Just the professional fee for the midwife. So facility fees alone, we save. Maternal care deserts exist across Alaska. By having at least one midwife in Seward, we reduce that to no longer being a maternal care desert because we have labor and delivery services available there in Seward. I'd like to highlight that there are demonstrated improved outcomes under certified professional and certified direct entry midwife care. The cesarean section rate right now under care with midwives in Alaska that are home and birth center direct entry midwives is 6% versus 23% with other providers. There have been zero maternal deaths in this provider population compared to all other provider populations and locations of birth since the pandemic. So I'd like to highlight that moms are very safe under the care of direct entry midwives. The board keeps the cost down for families and the state by ensuring that midwives are practicing at and above national standards. And I'd like to highlight that the Alaska State Legislature Division of Legislative Audit in October 14, 2022, on page 4 of the report states, the board is the only agency authorized to license midwives in the state and as such does not duplicate the efforts of other agencies. That we have been in compliance, midwives, with all audit recommendations to move and streamline licensing and regulation process to reduce costs and to eliminate duplication of function away from state oversight that did drive licensing costs up because of licensing examiners who did not understand which cases needed to be seen by investigators and which did not. It took 8 years between 2016 and now to get the
Next, we're going to move to Morgan Turner. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Morgan Turner. I am a mom, a former birth and postpartum doula, currently in training to be a licensed professional counselor specializing in perinatal mood disorders. I'm also the current president and co-founder of Alaska Birth Collective, a resource for birthing people in Alaska. I am encouraging you to vote no on EO 130. I believe that midwives should be autonomous in their oversight and that midwifery oversight is important for
keeping our standards really high, our care, the quality of care really high. And I'm very concerned about the unintended consequences that moving this board may have, particularly for our Alaskan families that use Medicaid to have their babies. And for the rest of us with private insurance, too, if we can't bill our insurance for using midwifery services, that is harming Alaskan families. I think that Alaskan moms deserve to have really highly qualified community midwives, and keeping their board intact and voting no on EO 130 is what I'm asking you to do. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Dominica Buck. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes. Dominica Buck, you can begin your testimony. Okay, we will move on to Kate Timmons. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Hi there. My name's Kate Timmons. I'm born and raised in Alaska. I've worked in healthcare as a respiratory therapist in critical care for 14 years. I'm currently a mother of four. My first two births were in a hospital L&D setting without the guidance of any midwifery care, while my third and fourth pregnancies were under close support and care of local midwives. Those two pregnancies and births under the midwives were far better experiences and outcomes for myself, my family, as well as my babies and their care. Not only are midwives essential caregivers through some of the most vulnerable, precious transitions in a woman's life, a midwife provides so much continued support and advice long after pregnancy and birth. The Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives is probably one of the most important skilled volunteer boards to exist. It's a proud honor to have in our state, honestly. Having seen the complete stripping of patients' rights through COVID in the hospital setting, the increased demand and necessity of midwives to support local moms and be strong advocates of our birth rights is essential and should be protected at all costs. I would argue it makes all the difference in the world having skilled midwives who have actual skin in the game when it comes to birthing babies and caring over our families' outcomes directly. This board is crucial to making decisions over the most important work in all the land, delivering our babies. And to protect the future of midwifery for our daughters and our granddaughters, I strongly encourage you all to vote no on EO 130 and yes on HB 175. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Karen Perry. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Hi, my name is Karen Perry of Chugach, and I may have missed this, but for the call-in number for those that need to call in is 907-563-9085. I am testifying as a mother of five, all born here in Alaska, and a grandmother of 11. One of my birth experiences was attended by the distinguished midwife, Pam Weaver. Pam was the midwife who was instrumental in getting certified midwife as a legal option in Alaska. I vehemently, vehemently oppose EO 130. Sad to say, I believe that EOs, in general, think of dictatorship. Is that what our state, or how our state should operate? EOs circumvent the voice of the people. We need to maintain the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives. We need to retain an educated and informed board of those certified in this profession. We do not need more state bureaucrats, especially when it comes to our health care options. State agencies just grow the size, scope, and expense of government. Our government is so big already, it probably can be seen from outer space. I am asking that you support the phenomenal midwives in Alaska, as do all those who have called in. I highly recommend that EO 130 to be vetoed by the legislature. Let the voices of the people be heard via our elected representatives, not a dictator. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Karen, for your testimony, and thank you for the call-in number. Just for the record, that is for the Anchorage prefix. All other callers, it's 844-586-9085. We will return to Dominica Buck. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you have 2 minutes.
Hello. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
My name is Dominica Buck. I live in Palmer. And today I speak as a doula, birth assistant, aspiring midwife, and also primarily mother. I've had 5 children with midwifery care and always experienced a responsible and compassionate care. I have also been a birth worker for about 5 years now, and I have observed and studied midwives and how they practice. And I have witnessed their love, compassion, prayers, and occasionally tears as well. I have also witnessed as they had to make the hard but safe decision to send people to physician's care and hospital setting, and that happened either before, during, or after labor. And the reason that we have responsibly practicing midwives in the state of Alaska is because of the Board of Midwives and the licensing requirements that they created and how they oversee this profession. So the board understands this profession and ensures that it's run well in our state. And from where I stand, being exposed to midwifery care in personal and professional capacity for about 12 years, I'm so proud of the midwives that we have. Dissolving the Board of Midwives will negatively affect our community in various ways. Some we can already think of, and some we will see as a result of this. If we decrease the accessibility to midwifery care, families that don't feel comfortable with hospital care are going to be forced to do 2 things. One would be birthing at home on their own without medical care. And this will increase the mortality numbers in our state, and I would absolutely hate to see that. Another thing we would see would be families being forced to birth in a hospital where they do not feel safe for whatever reasons. Such experience can and will affect the labor process, which will result in medicated births, higher C-section rates, breastfeeding struggles, and unfortunately postpartum depression as well. So I think that we can all agree, and we want Alaska families of this beautiful state to grow safely and joyfully, and that is why we should listen to what they want. A respect to the midwives has been expressed earlier. A statement of no blame to the current board members has been established. So why put energy and expenses to dissolve this board instead of supporting the board and the midwives? Because replacing the experts in the field by someone who does not understand this field very much doesn't feel respectful. I'm Dominica Buck, and I very much oppose the Executive Order 130. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we're going to go to the Fairbanks LAO. We got Kate Parks, and I apologize for missing Fairbanks LAO. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Kate Parks in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm a certified direct entry midwife, licensed in the state since 2016, and a certified professional midwife. And I thank you for hearing our testimony here today. I want to implore you to oppose Executive Order 130. A little history is I began my apprenticeship in 2013. I had been a doula before that with midwives Dana Brown and Cheryl Corrick, who were, at the forefront of licensure in our state and both served for many years as on the board. Both had been chair on our board. And my primary preceptor, Dana Brown, was actually the 9th midwife licensed in the state. Our board's been in place for decades. I worked from 2013 to 2022, the end of 22, in the longest standing nonprofit birth center in Alaska up here in Fairbanks that had been open for more than 30 years and was founded by, midwives that had really been part of our formation of our state in our state. And it closed last year, and I primarily contributed to a shift in leadership to non-midwives. When midwives are managed by people that do not understand the profession, there is little understanding of our mission, of what we do, of what our training is, of what our scope of practice is, and that birth center closed very shortly after I left in 22. And we no longer have a freestanding birth center here in Fairbanks. I am one of 2 certified direct entry midwives in Fairbanks, and my partner Joy is the only certified direct entry midwife and only primary maternity care provider in Delta Junction. and she worked with me in my practice. Midwives are not commodities. We save lives, both physically and emotionally. We deserve to be governed by a group of our peers. I've spoken to many midwives around the country that are involved in legislation and licensure of our profession, and they are aghast at this move to eliminate our board. One of the first things many of them say is how Alaska is a model of midwifery. Our history, legislative action, regulation, and practice standards serve as a flagship for many other states. People follow our example, and this is one example that I hope we don't do, because this is definitely not the example to follow. We have the highest rates of consumers of community midwifery and people who choose to give birth at home or in community birth centers. We have a rural population, and yet we're able to maintain choice for our population when it comes to their maternity care and where they give birth. There are many places in our country that are considered maternity care deserts where midwifery is unnecessarily restricted and maternal and infant mortality and morbidity rates are equally concerning. Restricting our autonomy in a state like ours would be a step back and would put our public safety and families at risk. I believe the governor is misinformed on this issue, as our board is self-sustaining and serves to regulate a profession that has served thousands of families over many decades. The bottom line is Executive Order 130 is unnecessary, couldn't impact the availability of safe community midwifery care, and is blatantly un-Alaskan.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Next, we have Cynthia Early at the Anchorage LAO. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Cynthia Early. I'm here in Anchorage. I've been a licensed midwife in the state of Alaska for 8 years, and I'm also a certified professional midwife. I urge you to support midwifery by opposing Executive Order 130. I believe abolishing our board will harm midwifery and, in turn, women, newborns, and families. I think that this should be alarming to both ends of the political spectrum, as the Executive Order 130 is neither pro-life nor pro-choice. I want to speak specifically to points that were brought up by Sarah Chambers regarding the concerns about Medicaid coverage. As previously mentioned in other testimony, Medicaid policy wording states that it reimburses midwives licensed by the Board of Direct Entry Midwives. If there is no board, it's not a stretch to believe they will no longer reimburse us. We don't believe the reassurances given by Sarah Chambers, because we already saw how having our license expiration dates extended by 3 months last year, after we were reassured that Medicaid would be informed of this, resulted in every midwife receiving a letter from Medicaid erroneously accusing us of having lapsed licenses and denying coverage until the matter was cleared up. In addition, Sarah Chambers' comments about board delays due to busy schedules and members not being available. She doesn't offer evidence of these delays, only speculation. But interestingly, 2 years ago, I took it upon myself to audit our board's meeting minutes since its inception. And what I found was of the 49 board meeting minutes available on the state website, that out of 23 of those meetings, either the certified nurse midwife member or the OB member was not in attendance, so nearly 47% of the time. And on only 5 of those occasions was a certified direct entry midwife member not present. And never were both of the CDM members not present. And so I believe that this shows that certified direct entry midwives do know how to run a board, do know how to show up, and do the good work. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Annika Sprockreef. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi there. My name is Annika Sprockreef. I am a licensed midwife here in Anchorage. I'm also the president of the Midwives Association of Alaska. I've been a practicing midwife in Alaska for over 12 years now. And in that time, I have seen the State Department be at fault for many of delays in licenses, relicenses, practices by the employees and not the Board of Midwives. So it is unclear to me how shifting from a Board of Midwives to the department will make things more efficient. And I also worry whether the position can be filled at all with the numerous vacant positions at the state level currently. I wanted to just echo some of the previous testimonies by
saying that licensed midwives, we continuously have to defend and describe, define our profession. Although we as midwives, we love the people we collaborate with, our colleagues in the birth working field. We're not doulas who solely provide social support for families. We're not nurse midwives who may practice in and out of the hospital setting, but may not have any out-of-hospital experience. We're not OBs. We're not surgeons. We are midwives. We're knowledgeable, extensively trained, skilled professionals, primary care providers for maternity care. And we're the only providers who have specific training in perinatal care in the community setting. I think eliminating the Board of Midwives was a very big oversight by the governor, and I encourage you to oppose Executive Order 130. Additionally, I call for your support in House Bill 175, and this aims to move midwifery forward in Alaska, and it aligns our statutes with our regulations. It brings our practice up to the CPM, or Certified Professional Standard, which is the national licensing body. I'm also a CPM. And it increases all of Alaskan families to have access to midwifery services under their insurance plan.
Thank you. Next, we have Evie Offheim. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, my name is Evie Offheim of Palmer, Alaska. I am a mother of three children, all born here in Alaska with the help of midwives and midwifery prenatal and postnatal care. I just gave birth to my third. My primary care is under midwives right now, and this is hitting me very raw, 2 months postpartum. Please vote no on Executive Order 130. This board must be allowed to and supported to continue to ensure the responsibility and integrity of midwifery care for mothers and babies in our communities. EO 130 at best will limit our already limited medical care options, and at worst, take away the ability to get access to this necessary branch of care, as well as possibly losing insurance coverage for future home births with midwifery care. I trust midwives to govern over midwifery care. I do not see any benefit in forming a state-run committee, nor do I trust it. This, by admission from this forum, will not save the taxpayer, but add costs. I echo what all of those before me are testifying. Please serve us, your constituents, by voting no on Executive Order 130 and yes on HP 175. Thank you for hearing my voice.
Thank you. Next, we have Lindsay Ward. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Lindsay Ward, and I'm here to ask that EO 130 be vetoed by the legislature, and that we can support in keeping the Alaska Board of Midwifery safe and supported. It's not a board that needs to be overrun or overtaken. It's a board that needs to be supported. I have four children. I have one that was born in Alaska, and my husband's military, and so we don't live in Alaska now. But after two very traumatic hospital births, I was very grateful to have the option and the ability to birth in the comfort of my own home. My labor and my delivery was very fast. And I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have any choice but to give birth in a hospital. I was treated very poorly with both of my boys. Hospital care and midwifery care, it literally does not even compare as far as the east is from the west, the north is from the south. Midwifery care is something that needs to be treasured and valued and protected. They treat you like a person, not a patient. You're not just an appointment. Somebody said earlier, they are superheroes because they're not just saving lives, but they're saving emotions, I think she said. And that literally could not be a truer statement. I remember how traumatized I was after my first son was born by the very unnecessary interventions I was given. His heart rate was dropping. I was almost rushed to an emergency C-section because of everything that was going on. And I swore I would never have kids after that. I ended up having my second son, and I physically could not afford a home birth. And then in Alaska, we were able to through our insurance and through Medicaid. And it was a very healing, an emotionally healing experience. So this is, again, I ask that everybody votes a no on EO 130.
Thank you. Next, we have Jessica Deshowski. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Jessica Deshowski. I am a diplomate in clinical chiropractic pediatrics and a doctor in chiropractic. I'm an instructor for pediatrics and pregnancy and perinatal care here in Alaska and also out of state. I have taught at midwifery conferences and other birth conferences. I've had two home births assisted by midwives, which is not for everyone, but it is for many, many families. And it is for those families that I speak today. I want to add my testimony to the others, where I know that the midwives are a constantly professional group striving to improve their skills in education, as well as a phenomenal group for collaborative care for families in different arenas, whether it's the mainstream medical or in alternative care. What I love about midwives is that they are able to do that because of their professional status and their knowledge in the medical community, as well as their heart for the care for the families that they serve. The demographics of my patients are similar to the demographics served by midwives in regards to how they are paying for their care, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, whether it's self-pay or insurance. What I'd like to add is that it doesn't matter how a person pays. It's their choice and should be their choice based on ability to make those decisions based on the fact that they should not be harbored by any kind of governmental bill that could oppose the opportunity for midwives to provide that care. You are likely here, each of you, because your grandmother or your great-grandmother or your great-great-grandmother had midwifery care. It's been around eons longer than all of the birth professionals. And I'm not saying this because this is a versus. This is about familiarity and availability for families who may not otherwise be able to choose midwifery care if anything is interrupting the opportunity for them to have the state or Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera, pay for that care. Thanks. Children that are born with midwifery care here, especially in Alaska, improve significantly statistical infant morbidity and mortality rates, as well as maternal and perinatal rates. They are improved by midwifery care. Again, this is not a versus, but this is an opportunity for us to keep healthcare options open for families. I oppose EO 130. Please veto this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. That is everybody online. Coming back to the room, I think we have Ellie Osler. Sorry we missed you. Please approach for your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eleanor Osler. My roles as a home birth mother of five, doula, and former midwifery student make me acutely aware that the medical field and mainstream society historically hold disdain for out-of-hospital midwifery care. Participants in home birth are viewed as less educated, less intelligent, less safe, less sophisticated, less worthy. Dunleavy's unprompted decision to dissolve the board of CDMs demonstrates that he too carries these opinions. Removing midwives from the center of their professional regulation in favor of unreachable staff and advisory boards adds a layer of bureaucracy, between the midwives and their clients that will ultimately affect a quality of care. Sweeping the midwifery board into the receptacle of the Department of Commerce with the boards of hairdressers and massage therapy is not a great look for a pro-life administration. Clearly, the physical safety and emotional well-being of the mothers and babies mean no more to Dunleavy than a haircut or a massage. This EO is a slap in the face to the elder midwives who fought for our freedom to choose how we birth our children. Alaska has been at the forefront of safety and legislation for out-of-hospital births for nearly 30 years because of the creation of the board and the resulting legislation regarding midwifery. We have fantastic regulations and high educational standards for credentialing our CDMs. As I consider the possible ramifications of this decision, it is becoming more and more apparent that this executive order will be a death blow to this profession. Between myself and my sister-in-laws, 10 of the 17 babies in our family, were born into the hands of CDMs in Alaska. We love our midwives passionately, and we stand for freedom and birth choices. Those of us who birthed with CDMs are proud of our choices as autonomous women with agency who made informed decisions about our births with caregivers who have earned our trust. The 567 Alaskan mothers who delivered babies with CDMs last year had the freedom to choose because we have a board that ruled well and made sound decisions based on years of education and practice. The board is self-sufficient, operating out of the dues of licensed midwives. Presently, the board is staffed with CDMs, an OB, and a nurse midwife who speak their input into matters that concern out-of-hospital birth. It is nonsensical and inefficient to dissolve this board and put decisions into the hands of unqualified people who have no vested interest in the midwifery model of care. The fallout of this proposed change opens the door to taxing an overburdened healthcare system with more low-risk patients and shrinking access to care. This is unethical. It is heartless to threaten the livelihood of a small but essential group of women who care for Alaskans' families. If this proposed change is healthy for the practice of midwifery, I would challenge the committee to consider why the OB and RN boards are not also being dissolved and absorbed by the Department of Commerce, where they too can have their regulations and political representation dictated by unaffected government employees and the whims of changing administrations. Please stand with the midwives and the thousands of women who have birthed with them and vote down EO 130. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else in the room wishing to testify? Okay, seeing nobody, I will close public testimony on EO 130. Were there any questions from the committee for Mrs. Chambers?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a number of questions. I know we're up against time. I don't know if that's a possibility to have her come back.
We have all the time in the world, Representative Ruffridge.
Okay, then I'm ready.
Mrs. Chambers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Sarah Chambers, Department of Commerce, and just so you're aware, I am happy to come back if it's the will of the committee, so tonight or later, at your discretion.
Do you have questions now, Representative, or do you wish to wait?
We can wait if that would be okay.
Is that okay? It sounds like it's the will of the committee to hold this for another hearing, where we will have invited testimony and more questions. So thank you. I guess with that, we will adjourn. The time is 5:25 p.m.